Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Welcome, folks. You're listening to Homeopathy World Community's Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S., co-hosted by vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips and Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Brock. This is Alan Phillips, and Debbie Brock is traveling today, so it's not going to be able to be with us, but we have a special guest with us filling in. So we've got, as always here, tons of material to cover. Share some news and information about your rights concerning vaccines in the U.S. With us today, Mr. Rich Roberts, manager of the Pandemic Response Project. Rich, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on the show, Alan. I trust you're doing well today.
I am holding up the best I can. I tell you, Rich, I keep referring to this, but the health care world arena has exploded this fall like it never has, at least in terms of what I'm seeing. Healthcare workers around the country being required to get, mostly it's flu shots, but I'm also hearing concerns regarding Tdap and MMR and hepatitis B vaccines. For years, and in some cases decades, healthcare workers have been strongly recommended to get flu shots, but many, many of them have not. In fact, in some cases, as many as 30, 40, 50% or more have opted out. And I hear over and over again that many healthcare workers don't want the flu shot, but a lot of them are actually afraid, and I hear this from all over the country, afraid that they'll be fired just for asking for an exemption, so they don't even ask for an exemption. And many hospital policies are overstepping legal bounds, and people are sort of excluding themselves without realizing that their hospital policies are violating federal law and too restrictive in terms of what they allow. But despite that, the numbers of them, healthcare workers, that are saying, well, I don't accept this, let me get more information, and the number of those that come to my door this year has just multiplied over the last couple of years, and so this issue is just getting bigger and bigger, and I'm getting less and less sleep, but I'm proud to do so to help people.
I'm sorry you're so busy, Alan, but that's the good news, actually, is that you are busy because it means more healthcare workers are waking up and standing up for their rights.
Exactly. And so this is really interesting, you know, as we keep talking about the vaccine machine is aggressively really rolling forward, in some instances, over people's legal rights. And it's aggressive on multiple levels, but at the same time, I am cautiously encouraged because I see more and more people speaking out. And within that community, more and more medical doctors as well. I've had several medical doctors contact me this fall asking for help to avoid the flu shot. So it's not just the occasional radical nurse or data entry person or what have you. It's including medical doctors as well. So this is a very interesting situation. And if it keeps going the way it's going, where there's movement on both sides of the issue, that's got to come to a head at some point, and there will be a loud crash, possibly explosion, and high flames or whatever. But it's going to be very interesting. And, of course, we're going to be continuing through this show to bring news and information to you about these issues. Rich, I saw something. I'm going to, if I may, jump out here first with something I saw that was fascinating to me. You know, I tell my clients and others you never know it all. You're always, you know, God willing, I will keep learning more. There are certain aspects of this issue that I feel, in terms of the legal rights and boundaries, that I feel that I have a pretty good solid grip on, but I learned an exciting new one recently. There was an article in Vermont Digger, or the web address, VT for Vermont, vtdigger.org. First Amendment rights cited in objection to new vaccine exemption form. Lawyer warns parents might sue state. Now, Vermont, there was an attempt by the legislature there in recent months to remove the philosophical exemption altogether. And the good news is that there was enough stink raised about that from folks who did not want to lose the exemption that the legislature opted ultimately to keep the philosophical exemption. The bad news is that parents have to sign a statement that they don't necessarily agree with. Now, I've talked a lot about the First Amendment in terms of what's called the Free Exercise Clause that refers to the free exercise of religion, and there's really a broad right in most vaccine mandate situations for people to opt out of vaccines for sincerely held religious beliefs, and there's a whole separate conversation about what does and doesn't qualify under the law there. But the First Amendment also includes our right to free speech, and this is the first time I had seen a reference to protecting the right to free speech as grounds for opposing a state law. So in this particular instance, let me see if I can find the attorney's name here. An attorney by the name of Mitchell Pearl is objecting to the language and with a group of parents objecting to the language in the Vermont form. The form specifically says, I understand that failure to complete the required vaccination schedule increases the risk to my child and others of contracting, carrying, or spreading a vaccine-preventable infectious disease. There's another statement that says, I understand that there are people with special health needs in schools and child care facilities who are unable to be vaccinated or who are at heightened risk of contracting a vaccine-preventable communicable disease and for whom such a disease could be life-threatening. Now, the problem here, from a free speech point of view, and this is great, this is inspiring me, if I can find time to go dig around in the law and learn more about the right to free speech, because again, my focus in my work has been primarily the so-called free exercise, or referring to religious freedom. But the problem here, according to the attorney in this case, is that these two statements on the exemption form, and he says, this is a statement of scientific belief. Now, it may be true, and certainly the Department of Health believes it to be true, and many people agree with it, but not everybody agrees with it. And the constitutional problem here is requiring a parent to affirm that they believe it to be true, even if they personally disagree with a statement, and even if their religious beliefs might prevent them from making a statement. So they're really looking at two different First Amendment issues here, the free speech and free exercise of religion. But the constitutional issue is whether a parent can be forced to affirm a particular statement, even if they don't believe it, as a condition of enrolling their children in school. And it's really interesting because apparently the First Amendment not only protects the right to free speech, but protects a person from being required to speak as well. And it's fascinating to me because on one level it's fairly straightforward and simple. You know, can the state require you to say something you don't agree with? And is that a violation of your free speech rights? Fascinating question. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. But this is an issue that has potential application in many other states as well. Like I know right off the top of my head, Michigan has a form that they require people to sign that parents don't agree with. Pediatricians around the country are requiring that parents sign a so-called refusal to vaccinate form, which basically requires you to say that you're a bad parent for exercising a vaccine. And even a private practice physician may be violating your constitutional rights if they accept Medicaid and Medicare. If they have that tie to government, then the constitutional rights that ordinarily only apply to government may also apply to a private business. So This is an interesting question. What the attorney and these parents are telling the health department is fix the form or we may have to sue you to get a judge to order that. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. Stay with us. We'll bring you all the updates we can as they come up. Rich, what have you – I know you've been digging around in the news a little bit yourself lately. What has caught your ear?
Well, before I go on, let me just say something about this this issue, Alan, and
sure,
ask you a question.
Means.
My hat's off to people who would refuse to sign that. And obviously, people who are not vaccinating are not going to agree with that statement. I mean, the state is asking these people to agree that they're putting their child's health and other children's health at risk. So that's nonsense. And it's interesting that this is a First Amendment issue because, I do think of the First Amendment as free speech. But you're right. It would also involve not forcing people to say things that they don't believe in. I think lay people might tend to think of the Fifth Amendment as kind of covering that, but that's really more for self-incrimination and testifying against oneself. So that is interesting. I guess my concern about signing something like this is, there's an old saying that the devil always tricks us in contracts. And so if people sign off on that and they're kind of signing their name to, agreeing that they're putting their children and other children at risk, then what kind of legal framework does that lay the groundwork for, Are they going to come back later and say, well, you yourself agreed that, you were taking these huge chances and putting children's lives at risk. So it just really seems like it would be a foolhardy thing to do to sign that paper.
Well, you raise a really important question there because a lot of parents, when they're asked to sign something like that, they're afraid to sign it. Am I going to later be held responsible for some other kid getting sick? And, God forbid, it's the rare occasion when somebody has a serious permanent problem or even dies from an illness. There's no 100% safe path in life with any issue, we keep wanting, and reasonably so, of course, as human beings, to try to minimize at least the larger risks in life. But inherently, this reality is ultimately unpredictable to one degree or another, moment to moment, day to day, week to week. And so, we can find ways to try to minimize risk, but ultimately you can't control it absolutely
right.
As much as many of us would like to do that or like to pretend that we can do that. But there's, it's a valid question. If I have to say something that I agree that my not vaccinating puts others at risk, then if others have a negative consequence, have I just admitted liability? Am I now legally, financially responsible for somebody else's harm? And it's a fair question. I don't know that really necessarily would be how things would play out, but the concern, the question, the fear, as a matter of principle and with regard to the practical realities is a very reasonable question for folks to ask. I had a real similar question, a version of that, where somebody said recently that they were told by, this was a healthcare employee, they were told by a hospital administrator that they have to get vaccinated because if somebody gets the flu and, gets hurt or killed or whatever, the hospital is going to be liable if you're not vaccinated. And so the question was, is that true?
Right.
And it's a really interesting question. Just for clarity's sake, I don't give legal advice on the air. Everything we say is intended to be educational and exploratory only, not to give legal or medical advice on the air. But let me give and I think that's a question for me that bears further consideration and possibly some research. But off the cuff, if it has become or is the standard for hospitals to require flu shots, as is quickly becoming the case around the country, then I think if somebody could show that, let's say, a patient caught the flu because one hospital was negligent, they didn't get all their employees vaccinated like everybody else does, then I think hypothetically there might be some kind of liability there, maybe in negligence or some other arena. But the practical reality is that the flu virus is ubiquitous, and being vaccinated doesn't keep you from spreading the flu virus around. As a practical matter, could you ever show medically and scientifically at a level that would hold up in court that a particular employee's failure to vaccinate could lead, what was actually the cause of somebody else getting sick and then, you know, again, God forbid, dying or having some severe consequence? I think it would be a virtually unprovable proposition. So to me, it was just another example of how authorities in some instances will just sort of overreach science, overreach the law, overreach in any way they can, professionally, morally, ethically, and sometimes legally, to achieve their goal. And as sincere as the person arguing that point may have been, because a lot of people really buy into all the hype about the safety and effectiveness of flu vaccines. They don't look any further than what they're told, and so they really believe it. But the people who are driving this whole thing know exactly what they're doing, and they know the flu vaccines are ineffective. They know that they're harmful to a lot of people, and there are just our financial and probably other agendas as well behind all of this. So,
I suppose, you know, my thinking on it, Alan, I completely agree with you that it seems as if it would be literally impossible to prove any kind of causal relationship between somebody not getting vaccinated and somebody else getting sick as a result. But it's kind of like when I look at this statement and think about people signing off on that, it seems like you could easily make a statement that, hey, they've just kind of, you know, legally agreed that they're guilty of negligence. Because how can you kind of agree that you're putting your children at risk and other people's health at risk and not be negligent? And so maybe that would be an even easier kind of legal angle to kind of try to punish people with.
Now, sometimes people, when they are presented with a form, sign this form and you can have the exemption, or sign this form if a doctor is saying, sign it and I'll treat your child, and people say, well, you know, I want the exemption or I want the doctor to treat my child, but I don't agree with this form, what do I do? And there's not always a real clear-cut answer to that question. You know, one possibility is, well, line through the parts you disagree with, initial that, and see if they'll take it. But usually they won't take a form when you do that. I think the next best thing, or maybe even better, I don't know, is people will sign a form, but they can put their name and then write after that or right next to their name, you know, I have read the above, but I do not agree with all of it.
Right.
Or I'm signing this, you know, against my will or under coercion or something like that. But I tend to lean more toward as just a general recommendation. Sign your name, but then add to it, I have read, but do not agree with all of the above, or something very similar to that. And then you've kind of made your point, but you haven't changed their form, which they don't like and usually won't accept. And you've fulfilled the requirement, you've signed the form, but you've left yourself an out so that you can live with yourself for one thing, but in case somebody were to want to try to use that against you later, there you have added the disclaimer, so to speak, that you could say, well, I did sign it, but I didn't agree with it, and I said so, you know.
Right.
So I think that's really the simplest and safest general way to approach those kinds of issues.
I think that's great advice. The sad reality is that, you know, many of us feel so bombarded with, you know, trivial contracts that we're more in the habit of just signing our name without even reading. And in this instance, that could be a dangerous practice.
Well, it can be anywhere. I'll give you a real quick example. It's going to go off topic, but I promise to be brief if that's possible with me. Many years ago, when I was married and had just been married, and my wife and I moved into our first house, it was a rental, and this was before I even thought about becoming an attorney, for what that's worth, and we sat down with the rental agent, and he handed us the contract to sign, and without giving it a second thought, my wife and I just picked up the contract and started reading it. We didn't think there was anything, you know, strange or unusual about that. But the rental agent's jaw dropped to the floor, and he says, I've never had anybody actually read the contract. People just sign it and, you know, move into the house or whatever. And I thought to myself, how odd. Why would anybody ever sign anything that they hadn't read so they knew what they were signing? And we found out when we read this that they were giving themselves authority to come in anytime they want to, day or night. And we objected to that. We said, if there's an emergency, you're welcome to come in and fix something, but no, you can't just come in any time, day or night, you know. So, you know, it's important to read what you sign. And it's a general rule. I never recommend that somebody, I wonder if that's a contradiction, as a general rule, never. Okay, let me start over. I generally recommend that people not sign something if they don't agree with it. Because your use of the word contract is apropos here, Rich. If you're signing something, you're saying you agree with it, and maybe there are legal implications or potential ramifications for signing something just sort of reflexively, so you can go on about your business. You know, people will sign credit card contracts, rental contracts, all kinds of contracts dealing with just day-to-day life that you have to sign it to go on with your life. And maybe most people, most of the time, nothing negative ever happens from it. But I tell you, if it's a really important issue like vaccines, you're wise anywhere, but especially if it's an issue where it's really critical and important to you to know what it is you're signing. So read these things, folks, and if you have concerns about signing it, there are many potential things to do. Talk with the person asking you to sign it, or sign it conditionally, as sort of I'm suggesting. But there are ways to deal with this. And I've seen another thing that's come up recently from folks in a couple of different states, where parents are being asked to sign a form that says, in the event of an outbreak, your unvaccinated child will have to stay home for the incubation period of the disease. That's often, your child can stay home for 3 weeks if one kid in the school or the class gets chickenpox, and even if it's a vaccinated kid who gets the chickenpox, which the CDC admits usually is a vaccinated kid. The CDC admits on their website that most outbreaks occur in vaccinated kids. That's because vaccines don't work in everybody. Well, I don't see any issue about signing or not signing a letter like that, because the law is the law whether or not you sign the letter. You know, if the law says your kid has to stay home during an outbreak, then your kid has to stay home during an outbreak. And if you disagree with that, you know, go talk to your health department or legislators and get that fixed or changed. And I can give you some potential legal arguments for why that should be changed. But in the meantime, the law is what it is. So probably what schools are doing when they ask you to sign that kind of form, they're probably just asking you to, or making sure that they have a record that you know that that's a consequence. It's another way of saying, you don't really want to leave your kid unvaccinated, do you? Don't you really just want to go ahead and vaccinate your kid? It's a subtle form of coercion, I think, and parents can sign it or not, you know. If somebody shows you a law that says you have to sign it, then you probably have to sign it. But that, you know, the law is the law whether you sign a letter saying you know about it or not. So, Rich, let's move on to unless you have any other questions or comments there. Let's move on to another topic, because there's a lot of interesting things for us to talk about today.
Okay, I wanted to speak today about an article here that I have in front of me. It is entitled, The Vaccine Hoax is Over. And this is by Andrew Baker from Food Freedom. And I love that title, Alan, and perhaps that title is a little bit optimistic, but I'm going with the idea that our thoughts create our reality. So I thought I would dwell on this article and this thought, because I certainly hope that the vaccine hoax is over. But this article, I kind of like to cover the good news first. So let's just take a look at this article. It starts off by discussing a Freedom of Information Act that was recently filed in the UK by a doctor. And it was revealed that from 30 years of secret official documents that the government experts in the UK have, number one, known that the vaccines don't work. Number two, known that the vaccines cause the diseases they're supposed to prevent. Number three, that the government experts have known that vaccines are a hazard to children. And number four, that the government experts have colluded to lie to the public. And number five, that they have also worked to prevent safety studies. And so these are the same vaccines mandated here in the U.S. And I just really like the way they kind of laid that out so blatantly there. And it is a little general, but this is a relatively recent kind of article, so I hope we'll get some more information about some of the details that are backing up these statements, but it sounds pretty much right on to me, Alan.
Well, it certainly supports, or let's say it's consistent with information that we have heard and that has been documented about these issues here in the U.S. You know, I'm sure we've talked about this before, but just real quick example, there's a nonprofit organization here in the U.S. called the Coalition for Mercury-Free Drugs, or COMED for short, and they got some information here in the U.S. last year through the Freedom of Information Act that showed that what they ended up with was some emails between CDC officials and study authors back in the earlier part of the last decade, I think. And these emails were discussing whether or not to include some data in a study they were about to publish. And the data that they had that they were discussing was data that showed when they took the mercury out of vaccines, the autism rates went down over a period of years and continued to go down. And the resulting study that got published is a study that's called the Denmark study because it was looking at Danish children. Doctors and health authorities and CDC have been pointing to this Denmark study saying here's the definitive proof that vaccines don't cause autism because the study authors ultimately decided not to include the data that showed that the mercury in vaccines causes autism. Or certainly had a direct correlation to the autism incidence or autism rates. So I don't know any kind or polite words for that. I think that's just blatant criminal fraud. I think those people should be in jail, and I hope that there will be some prosecutions forthcoming on that issue. But the more general point here, again, just consistent with what the article you're talking about says happened in the U.K., is that study? There are people in the CDC and government health care agencies and positions who know that the vaccines cause harm. They know that some vaccines don't work. We've got publicly available government data strongly suggesting correlations between vaccines and many, many different forms of adverse reactions. It's the VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. Anybody can go on the internet, look it up, and look at the reports. Now, a report isn't proof that the vaccine caused the problem, but every one of them is a suspected vaccine injury or death. And then you could look at the injury, the Federal Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, NVICP. That's also public information available on the internet, and you can see the funds that have actually been paid out to people who have been injured and killed by vaccines. And so it's clear that vaccines cause these problems. What is not so clear, though, Rich, is the scope of the problem. Even the FDA and CDC have admitted in years past that 90 to 99% of vaccine adverse events are never even reported. So anybody who tells you, yeah, there's the occasional death or disability, but there's a net benefit, look at all the great good that vaccines, you know, do, there's no data available to make that calculation. So anybody who tells you that is either ignorant or lying, and I'm sorry that, to put it in sort of coarse terms like that, but that's really what it boils down to.
And a lot of the parents probably really don't know or put the two together, Alan, because the doctors are so hesitant to diagnose something as a vaccine adverse event. And so most people probably, you know, parents who have vaccine-damaged children, they don't know it, and they just err out of ignorance, and they have the full support of their pediatrician in coming to the incorrect conclusions.
Well, this is part of the reason that the reporting incidence is so low. I mean, one former FDA commissioner even suggested that the reports may be fewer than 1%. Doctors will tell you, no, it's not a vaccine reaction, it's a coincidence, there's no way the vaccine had anything to do with it. Now, they do it for one of two reasons, either because they really believe that, or because they're trying to protect the vaccine culture, or really basically themselves, because if you step out of the norm as a medical doctor, if you don't stay support the status quo, you will often put yourself at risk, your own career at risk. There is no freedom of speech in the healthcare profession, generally. I hear this from 100% of my hospital worker clients, and this is, again, dozens of people around all over the country. never had anybody say anything different, that the hospital work environment is very, very strict, militant. Many people refer to being bullied or feeling like they're being bullied. There is no room to express your own opinion or a different view than what they tell you is what you, you know, can or can't say, especially about vaccines, probably other areas as well. And the people who speak out, I mean, for every nurse or worker that comes to me and says, how do I avoid the flu shot, the majority of them are saying, and by the way, there's other people in my department who don't want the shot either, but they're afraid to even ask for an exemption. They're afraid they'll get fired just for asking. That's how oppressive the culture is. Because I keep hearing this over and over again, I've gotten to where I no longer call it the healthcare profession. I call it the healthcare oppression. Because it's a highly restrictive, oppressive work environment. The people I talked to went into their fields because they wanted to help people, and they want to stay there because they believe they can help people and are helping people, but they are very uncomfortable with the culture and environment for employees with regard to the restrictiveness of it. And so doctors will tell you, no, it's not a vaccine injury, it's a coincidence in time. But that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, scientifically or medically. You cannot say with regard to any specific injury whether or not it's vaccine-related, assuming as a starting point that it happened sometime after a vaccine was administered. You can't say so as a scientific matter. You cannot come to that conclusion unless you engage in some sort of testing to rule it in or rule it out with this specific case. So when doctors say that, it's not a medical opinion. It's not a scientific opinion. It's a cover-your-ass opinion. It's a, I'm going to say the right thing so that I don't damage or risk hurting my own career. And right. So the people who say that, you know, they are tiny, immature cowards, and because they are willing to help themselves first and put their patients second. Now, I understand it's easy to say that when I'm not in their situation, and I want to say that there's a part of me that says, you know, I don't judge people for doing that because I know that the situation is very oppressive and that they potentially are putting their careers at risk. But you know, somewhere at the end of the day, who do you answer to when it's all said and done? And, you know, I'm not going to answer that question for anybody else. Everybody has to search their own soul for that. But I do think it's cowardly of somebody to, in that situation, to protect themselves first by lying to a patient or the patient's parents, instead of being more forthright, truthful, and honest about it. And maybe some of them actually believe that, but even if you believe it, it doesn't matter, because if you believe the vaccine didn't cause it, it's not about what you believe, it's about what does the science tell us. Let's do the tests and find out.
Right.
So, of course, I'm assuming there is testing that would be available, and that probably depends on the specific situation. But let me see. I still want to keep away from death threats myself, so let me stop talking in that direction, Mitch, and let you...
Well, let me continue on here. You were talking about mercury and vaccines, and we all know that that is a very negative substance to inject into the bloodstream. I want to go through some other nasty ingredients in vaccines. But as far as mercury, you know, Alan, I hear this over and over again from the pro-vacciners that there's as much mercury in a tuna fish sandwich as there is in a vaccine, and I just kind of like to point out that it's a lot different when you eat something as opposed to when you inject it directly into your bloodstream, because anything that you inject directly into your bloodstream is bypassing all the body's natural defenses. And so that is a really, really lame argument that people make in support of mercury in vaccines.
Now let me just interject real briefly. We're not necessarily advocating that people eat as much tuna as they can if they think it has mercury in it. We're not saying that's a good thing, but your point is absolutely well taken, Rich. You know, injecting something in your bloodstream is very, very different, and there are certain kinds of things. Now, I don't know that mercury is one of them, but certain kinds of things that will pass right on through the digestive tract and maybe not even be absorbed or minimally absorbed in the body, whereas, of course, if you inject it into the bloodstream, there it is in your body. The body has no chance to filter it in advance. All it can do is the best it can to remove it now that it's there. And from what I have read and heard from doctors, that ability with heavy metals varies from person to person. Some people's bodies can eliminate heavy metals more effectively than others. And maybe that's part of the reason why some people have serious reactions to vaccines and others don't. But, you know, no thank you for me.
Right. Well, and another heavy metal, Alan, is aluminum. And for the folks who are into homeopathy or are familiar with Edgar Cayce, that was one of the main things that he warned about, especially as we get older, is taking aluminum into the system because it becomes nearly impossible for the system to eliminate that aluminum. So to think that we're injecting aluminum into our bloodstream, especially older folks with flu shots, well, it's criminal.
Yeah, and that's a really good point here because what you're really saying there is that, or one of the implications, let's say, of what you just, your comment there was, is that therefore with repeated injections, the aluminum is going to accumulate in your body and gives rise to a very legitimate question, is there potentially a cumulative effect? And there was a researcher who found that with seniors that the more consecutive annual flu shots they had, the more the greater the risk of Alzheimer's. And I've heard some different specific figures, but one of the ones that I thought I had read was that if you've had two or more, or maybe it was more than two, consecutive annual flu shots as a senior, your risk of Alzheimer's goes up by a factor of 10 compared to people who had had either one or no consecutive annual flu shots. So there is a potentially accumulative effect. And we also had a study published at the end of the year last year, peer-reviewed medical study, that concluded that the aluminum in vaccines may be a causally related to autism.
Right.
So there's more than just a suspicion or irrational fear out there about heavy metals in vaccines and their potential adverse effects. Now, there's research, you know, out there supporting these concerns. And even if there are different opinions out there, oh, it's in such minuscule amounts, it's not going to hurt anybody. Look, most kids don't have a serious reaction to vaccines or whatever. Okay, you know, I'll give room for opposing views. Everybody doesn't have to agree with my view on things, but let's all have the right to share our view, to have our view, and let's all have the right to act on what we think is best for us and our own children, because clearly the medical community cannot agree definitively or absolutely on any of this if you allow open review of all of the medical studies. And clearly, as we've said over and over again, there is corruption within the medical publishing industry, within the pharmaceutical industry and its promotion and sale of drugs, within the FDA and its licensing of drugs and equipment. There are serious problems with all these systems. Therefore, we should not be bound legally by the results from any of them or the opinions, you know, on one side of two-sided or multi-sided issues. Which brings me to sort of a mantra of mine that I keep coming back to, is that it's really critical, folks, for us all to become legislatively involved. And there is a way to do that that takes very little time, because very few of us, let's face it, you know, most of us, it's all we can do to almost keep up with our personal lives, let alone get outside of that to take on a legislative initiative. The good news is that most of us don't need to do that. You can join the NVIC, National Vaccine Information Center, NVIC Advocacy Portal at nvicadvocacy.org, O-R-G, free to sign up for, and you can monitor legislation in your state and around the country concerning vaccines and only vaccines. So that website, if you sign up, you can immediately find out who your state representatives are, have their phone numbers and email addresses, and when there's legislation in your state that you support or object to, you can quickly and easily let your representatives know. So if you do nothing more than that, folks, become legislatively involved by joining the NVIC Advocacy Portal. Rich, what else we got today?
Well, just to kind of finish the thought, let's look at some of these other terrible things in vaccines. Viral diseases, and that would make sense because the whole idea is to inject supposedly weakened or dead viral material into the body. Also, fecal material, DNA fragments from other species, and again, that makes sense, Alan, because they're growing these cultures and you know, living tissue. And so that one really worries me, because if you inject foreign genetic material into the body, then you know, it stands to reason that it's going to kind of find its way into the cell, into the nucleus, and then our own cells would start reproducing this foreign DNA, which could be, well, one, it seems to, you know, is that going to make us, are we going to start producing non-human, you know, cells, or is that going to be cancer-causing? That is a really, really alarming one right there. And
well,
also,
yeah, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, just to finish the list, formaldehyde, which sounds terrible, and polysorbate 80, which, as you know, Alan, that's a sterilizing agent. So how many people do we all know, you know, couples who've had to have massive medical intervention in order to conceive these days? And so perhaps, you know, the main culprit there might be vaccines, why so many people are sterile, or that at least that is one of the main culprits in my mind.
Well, you know, Rich, I spent decades ignoring the so-called conspiracy theories, and the more prominent ones involve the population reduction ideas and so forth, but I keep seeing more and more information points back in those directions. And the first time I became aware of polysorbate 80 as an ingredient in vaccines was with the swine flu vaccine back in 2009 and 10. And it's disturbing to me because polysorbate has been shown in medical research to cause fertility problems or infertility with lab animals, and particularly disconcerting to see that it raises the inclusion of that ingredient raises a absolutely bold and legitimate question about fertility or the potential impact on human fertility of humans getting those vaccines. And this was the first vaccine I heard of that ingredient being in, and it was in a time when, in a situation where pregnant women were a focus of the recommendation for the swine flu vaccines. The CDC has said, prior to that point anyway, that you never give a vaccine to a pregnant woman unless it's really, really critical to do so because, for obvious reasons, there aren't any studies out there showing whether or not vaccines have an effect and what the effect is on an unborn fetus. And it's just not ethical to even conduct those studies. You know, oh, let's see how many fetuses get hurt or killed, and then we'll know how safe it is. You know, you don't conduct studies like that. It's not ethical to do it. So there's not data out there. And if you look at the package inserts on vaccines, you will see that they say, this has not been studied, or the effects are unknown, or not recommended for pregnant women, and so forth. You see that on every package insert. And yet here was a situation where they had a vaccine with infertility causing ingredient that they were strongly recommending for pregnant women, and what turned out to be an exceedingly mild disease. They were the swine flu vaccine, the mortality rate from that virus was deemed to be something on the order of a third of what the seasonal flu was. And yet they gave it the highest level, pandemic level 6 designation that there is to give it. So, you know, what's wrong with this picture?
Right, and I have some statistics here from this article, Alan, from 2009. The number of vaccine-related fetal demise reports increased by 2,440% in 2009 compared to 2008, and that's a number more shocking even than the miscarriage statistic, which was a 700% increase. So it did appear that we had a very definite kind of, you know, result from lining up all
real
these pregnant
effect
women.
On fertility, huh?
Right. And
please go ahead.
I think, Alan, you're making such a great point about how the science doesn't exist on this because it cannot. And I think that's often overlooked. You know, we hear from the pro-vaxxers a lot of times, well, you know, there's no studies to show that it's unsafe. But, you know, think about how ridiculous that is. I mean, how are you going to test something like, you know, is mercury safe in a vaccine? Are you going to inject it into people's bloodstreams until you actually can observe that it's, you know, killing them? I mean, that is unethical science. That's Nazi science. And so the reason that the science doesn't exist on this is really because it cannot. And I think people need to wake up to that. And, you know, from a more common sense point of view, we can just sort of assume that there could be no benefit injecting heavy metals and mercury and aluminum and polysorbate 80 into our bloodstreams. And we don't really want to see the science on that because that would be inhumane science.
Well, it's a real interesting question in a sense because, or what's implied there, you know, is the burden on us to prove that it causes harm, or is it the burden on them to prove that it doesn't cause harm? And the only reason to me it would make sense for them to be right about, well, you need to show me it's harmful, you know, or else we get to do this. I mean, that implicit in there is the assumption that, well, everybody knows vaccines are helpful, and the only question is, are they also harmful? We have no data showing it's not harmful, so let's just go with the fact that it's helpful. You know, if it were really that simple, I could almost agree with them, you know. But, of course, it isn't. You know, when there's no study showing that it's harmful, that means there's also no study showing that it's helpful or effective.
Right, exactly.
So we don't know. It's a complete unknown. And when there's either an unknown or disagreement, you know, among medical experts, we should have the right to say yes or no without anybody telling us. Part of where the oppression, well, I think I lost my train of thought there. Boy, the time is flying by here, Rich, and so I want to try to keep us moving here.
Okay. Well, let me just kind of go on, and this is, you know, old news to you, Alan, but I never get tired of talking about this stuff, and I just feel like we do in this business have to say things over and over again until we see the change that we want. But as you know, the CDC has participated in designing pandemic laws that are on the books in every state now in the U.S., and basically they allow the government to use military force to force these untested vaccines on us if they declare that there is a pandemic emergency. And as we know from 2009, the CDC has no credibility in declaring that a pandemic emergency exists because they did it so, you know, lightly in 2009 when there wasn't really anything going on. So it looks like, you know, the CDC just puts out wildly exaggerated data on H1N1 cases and just, you know, creates a false impression of pandemic, and
well,
that's kind of where we stand
now.
Go ahead, Alan.
Just sort of generally concluded that positions of power attract people who want to exercise that power for personal or private agendas, or certainly a position of power is an opportunity for someone who wants to use it to further a personal or private agenda. To try and seek control of that position, to either occupy or control the person who occupies that position. And so just sort of by human nature in that regard, certainly not all humans are like that, but within humans collectively are many of humans who to one degree or another are perfectly willing to do that. And so over time, positions of power have come to be either occupied or controlled by people who are manipulating them to serve personal and private agendas. And so the circumstance that we have today is that, for example, the pharmaceutical industry really drives and controls policy and law at the state and federal level because they've gone to great efforts to control state legislatures and the federal legislature on health issues. It's not an absolute black and white 100% thing, I don't believe, but nonetheless, there's a high enough level of control and influence, and the vaccine issue is such a glaring example of that at all levels, local, state, and federal, because the policy that's in place and that continues to change and the direction it changes for the most part is in a direction that favors pharmaceutical profits at the expense of the safety and health of individuals and under a false pretense of protection that still, because of control of the media, dominates most people's thinking and beliefs and understanding. So obviously the first step for those of us who want to have a reasonable, rational, sane world is to share information and find ways to help people be able to see and hear the information, because frankly I think a lot of this is a psychological issue. People don't want to see the information we have. They don't want to look at it. They don't see how it could be right, so they're not going to waste their time looking at it in the first place. Or many people identify with mainstream so strongly that if it's not mainstream, it's automatically bad or wrong or not worth their time. And so it's a challenge psychologically to get people to even look at the issue sometimes or the controversy alternative issues in general. But But that's our goal, you know, as a starting place. But it's only a starting place because just being aware in and of itself doesn't stop the vaccine machine from rolling forward. So we do, again, ultimately need to become legislatively involved. But the Pandemic Response Project is something that I started back in 2009, and Rich, you joined on not long after, and it's been terrific having your support. The goal of the Pandemic Response Project primarily is to reform emergency health laws, primarily at the state level, because as you point out, Rich, most states have laws where if the state declares an emergency and mandates an emergency vaccine, the routine exemptions, religious and philosophical exemptions that we enjoy with routine vaccines, go out the window. And the laws are crafted in most states in such a way as if you refuse anyway, they can quarantine you, and they get to decide where and for how long and so forth. Now, there are to one degree or another, there are checks and balances, you know, in place in a lot of state laws, but the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, which was a model law that the CDC began pushing on the states to try to get states to enact this model law right after 9/11, and actually they began pushing it in December of right after the 9/11, so they were riding that wave of fear. And the model law has been aggressively criticized and challenged by a number of organizations and individuals as not including proper checks and balances on authority. And so many states have enacted for themselves overreaching authority, authority that goes beyond what they need to appropriately deal with infectious disease and other kinds of emergencies. And so we should be very concerned about that. So the Pandemic Response Project, again, as a primary goal, then, is to roll back these overreaching laws to, for purposes of vaccines, to give us the right to refuse vaccines whether or not there's an emergency. And if we need to be quarantined in a real emergency, okay, let's do that. But we want the right to do that in our homes if we choose to do so, and not to be potentially or hypothetically pulled out and put in a government facility somewhere. And I didn't used to think that that was a realistic threat, but I keep hearing about the so-called FEMA camps. The federal government has been building large camps around the country. What are they for? And you just, there's a point at which, you know, I don't want to just jump on the first conspiracy theory that comes by, but there's a point at which you look at the objective evidence and you say, what is going on here? What is the point of all of this?
Well, exactly.
So anyway.
They must have something in mind if they're constructing them, correct? So
they have something in mind. Now, you know, the official view is, oh, it's for emergencies, like if we have another Katrina or something like that. And let's face it, maybe we could have used some kind of better facilities and equipment and organization and so forth to have dealt with that issue much better than we did. But I'm not sure the answer to that is to build FEMA camps all over the country and to for the government to be purchasing tens of thousands of coffins and body bags to stock at all these places like they're expecting some kind of major cataclysmic disaster.
Right. It also rounds
up. Unless if they really are, they need to be telling us about it. Let's put it like that.
Well, exactly.
But
we have
Rich,
right now.
We're closing in on, if it's our government. We certainly should do have a right to know, you know, because we are the government, supposedly.
That's
Rich,
right.
We're closing in on the last, you know, 3 or 4 minutes here, 5 minutes or something. Where would you like to take this in terms of the news stories you've brought up, because you have some good ones there?
Well, I just would also like to point out, I think it's worth pointing out, among other things, Alan, this false pandemic of 2009, it was also a huge financial scandal, and it's easy to kind of pass over that, but you know, with budget shortfalls, and we talk endlessly about the debt of the U.S. government, but, you know, we spent billions of dollars in the U.S. for these false pandemic vaccines, and other countries did as well, and that just sort of gets swept under the rug. You know, we're living in an age of austerity, and we see people rioting in the streets because of social programs being cut, and so you have to ask yourself, well, what are we spending our money on here? And so that's kind of a fact that I'd like to bring out. And you know, it's just, for all that we're saying here, these pandemic laws are still on the books. And if that's not bad enough, as you well know, again, Alan, the Department of Health and Human Services has stepped in and removed all liability for any adverse reactions to these flu vaccines from the vaccine manufacturers. So not only are they mandating that we take them, they're turning around on the other hand and saying, oh, and if they damage you, then nobody is liable for that. So we're really kind of between a rock and a hard place.
It really are. I mean, if you throw morality and ethics out the window, and most of us can't do that, but obviously the pharmaceutical industry can and does on a regular basis, you throw morality and ethics out the window, it's the ideal business proposition. The population is required to get your products. You can keep adding more requirements by changing the laws that you have no liability for it. It's going to be the research is subsidized by the government. The vaccines are paid for by the government. The injuries are paid for by the government, and you have no liability. I mean, what could be a better deal from a pure, immoral, unethical business perspective? And let me clarify something. You know, a real quick example. Earlier this year, Glaxo had a $1 billion criminal fine and a $2 billion civil fine. And back in 2009, Pfizer had a $1 billion criminal fine and a $1.3 billion civil fine, and fines in the hundreds of millions of dollars, criminal and civil, are common in the industry. And these huge pharmaceutical companies will engage in criminal behavior on a regular basis. They'll do the same thing over and over and over again. Clearly, it must be profitable to do that or they wouldn't keep doing it, and or they wouldn't still be in business. And there was even at least one case where a huge 800-something million-dollar fine was reduced to $200 million so that the company could afford it. Thank you, court. Thank you. You know, because we don't want to, we don't want this company to go out of business because we want them to keep doing the same criminal behavior, so let's lower their fine so they can afford it. I mean, it's really silly to insane we think about it, but my point is this. This is an industry that regards moral, ethical, and legal boundaries as mere financial concerns or financial considerations. If it's profitable, if nobody's going to go to jail, they're going to keep doing it. And this is not something that we should tolerate as a society, because when you do that in the pharmaceutical industry, people suffer and die as a result. And why nobody goes to prison is sort of baffling to me, at least as a ethical and philosophical consideration. People should go to prison. If you know, you don't get a criminal fine unless you knew what you were doing and you did it anyway. And Pfizer's $2009 billion criminal fine was the fourth time they'd been caught doing the same criminal behavior since 2002. This is not something we should tolerate, even if they are successful in keeping it off the 6 o'clock news. So we, again, this comes back to we need to change the laws. We need to have laws enacted that require prosecution and criminal jail sentences for the people who are responsible for this. You do that, I guarantee the incidents will go down dramatically and quickly. Won't go away, but it'll go down.
Well, I agree, Alan, because the people aren't held, they're not being held accountable. The people behind it need to be held accountable as people, but they hide behind the facade of the corporate kind of identity. And so then we have this kind of idea that, oh, well, we fined the corporation, so they were punished. But no, because the fines are just a drop in a bucket in the bucket compared to the revenues they're making. So we have to stop letting people hide behind, you know, the corporate facade. I mean, we need real people to be held accountable for real crimes, and no more of this kind of financial slap on the wrist for a, you know, hazy kind of corporation which really has no identity.
Yeah, well, I agree with you completely, Rich. Rich, I hate to say it, we're out of time. I really appreciate having you here today. It's been great. I hope you'll come back. We missed Debbie today, but it was wonderful having you with us, Rich. Lots of good discussion topics today. We'll look forward to seeing you back in the future. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. on Blog Talk Radio's Homeopathy World Community. Co-hosted most of the time with Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Bruck and myself, vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips. We're here Thursdays at noon live, noon Eastern time, on Blog Talk Radio, but all the shows are archived. You can listen to the archives. And if you are with the live show, there is a call-in number that you can find on blogtalkradio.com. Look up Homeopathy World Community and Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. and get that number and call in. And you can also email me during the week if you want your question answered on the air that you can listen on the air or listen to in the archives. Rich, great having you with us. Look forward to seeing you again soon. Folks, come back with us next week. Take care.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Your truth.